Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, a new violent chapter in the Israel-Palestine conflict. 9 days into the latest round of fighting, and both sides say they have no plans to stop the assaults. The death toll in Gaza is now more than 200. In Israel, 10 have been killed by Hamas rockets. A complex set of events helped spur this latest round of fighting. And now, despite mounting international pressure, leaders on either side do not seem interested in finding a path to peace. Aaron David Miller is senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was a Middle East negotiator in both Democratic and Republican administrations. He joins me to talk about where this situation is headed and the role of the Biden White House. Aaron, the fighting between Israel and Hamas is now into its second week. Compared to past hostility, how would you characterize what we're seeing?
I mean, I think that this conflict, which is now multidimensional across three fronts, in many respects is unique. You've got a Jerusalem issue over the last several weeks coinciding with Ramadan, driven by, I would argue, very careless and, in my judgment, provocative Israeli acts in and around Jerusalem and the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount. You have communal violence that is unprecedented in the modern history of the state and is reminiscent of conflicts between Jewish and Arab citizens of Israel in the 20s and 30s before there ever was a state. And you have a Hamas-Israeli confrontation, which may not be as deadly as the one in 2014, which went on for 50 days and cost anywhere from 2,200 to 2,300 Palestinian lives, six Israeli civilians killed and 67 soldiers, largely as a consequence of a ground incursion the Israelis launched then. Now, there is a symmetry of casualty. I mean, 11 Israelis killed and over 200 Palestinians killed. You have a quarter of those, and the estimates aren't exact, are children. The intensity and range of the Hamas rockets have increased, and the number of artillery and airstrikes that the Israelis have conducted over the course of what is now 9 days, I think in comparison with 2014, there's clearly been an uptick. Oh, one more point, Diane. I do not remember any of these Hamas conflicts, 2008, 09, 2012, and 2014, and this one, in which all sides admit that there is no political process, no sense of hope. That's the final point, which I think makes this more distressing than the previous rounds between Israel and Hamas.
Can you give me an understanding of how and why this latest outbreak began?
I think it's a combination of an all too familiar backstory, which involves 50 plus years of Israeli occupation, a dysfunctional and divided Palestinian national movement, a part of which Hamas has not given up the gun, and the absence of any political process. And those three sorts of elements provide the sort of background. The actual triggers that lit the fire, as we mentioned before, involved during the holiest month of the Muslim year, Ramadan, a series of, I call them careless and provocative Israeli decisions. The first was to close the plaza in front of the Damascus Gate, which traditionally has been a place where Palestinians gather with their families.
Why would they do this?
There's no precedent for doing it in a relatively normal security situation. And keep in mind, according to Amos Harel, the Haaretz military correspondent, the period January to April of this year has been one of the quietest, least confrontational 4 months in recent years. It's unclear why they did it. You also had on the, during the first week of Ramadan, the president of Israel, Ruvi Rivlin, was giving a speech at the Western Wall. The police, for reasons that are still not clear, disconnected the sound system, which prevented the Muslim call from prayer for being heard. That was accompanied by the legal toggling back and forth of the evictions of six Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah. That has been building for decades. TikTok videos, which Palestinian youth posted, which showed them slapping Orthodox Jews on Israel's light rail system. Confrontations in the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Haram during Ramadan, in which the Israeli police used stun grenades inside the mosque. Stone throwing, which led to that action by Palestinians, by the Israeli police, until last Monday. And in an effort, best sense I can make of it, to capture the public mood of frustration and anger, Hamas decided, having issued an ultimatum the day before to the Israelis, to launch 150 rockets, seven or eight of which were launched in the vicinity of Jerusalem. They did that, I suspect, to make a play for becoming the preeminent part of the Palestinian national movement. They did it because they were angry at Abbas for canceling elections. They did it to appear to be the redeemers and defenders of Jerusalem. And the Israelis, believing Hamas had now changed the rules of the game, responded. Now, the Jerusalem peace has quieted down. The communal violence also has quieted down. Whether it will rise up again is unclear, but we're now left with a nine-day, well, you call it a mini war, between Israel and Hamas, which, as of today, neither side is ready yet to accept a stand down and a ceasefire.
I want to go back to that initial action during Ramadan. Who ordered that first action? Who said, keep the Palestinians out?
Well, it wasn't so much a question of barring Palestinians as it was violence. You have an inexperienced, newly minted head of police. You've got a minister of internal security who is a devotee of the prime minister, and by any standard is an ideological hardliner. A lot of this decision-making is partly related to the fact that for the last 2 years, you haven't had a functioning Israeli government. No budget, no additional monies to the ministries. I think it was largely a function of not paying attention, a sort of willful bias against Palestinians by the current government, inexperienced police, and a willingness to allow right-wing extremists in the Knesset. One gentleman in particular, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who did his utmost, I think, during the last several weeks to provoke and cause trouble in Jerusalem. All of these things are circulating. It's a toxic environment. And we're now left with a situation in which we're farther than ever away from having leaders and constituencies on both sides who are prepared to tamp things down, let alone to move ahead with any sort of political process.
What responsibility would you ascribe to Benjamin Netanyahu?
I mean, I'm just reporting here. Benjamin Netanyahu is concerned primarily about one thing, which is he's the ultimate pal, the longest governing prime minister in Israel's history, exceeding that of Israel's arguably greatest prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. He has sought for the last 2 years unsuccessfully through four elections to form a government. if he couldn't form the government, then his next tack was to prevent others from doing so. Several days before Hamas rockets, the so-called Coalition of Change, which is an unwieldy group composed of center, right-wing, and left-wing parties, was this close to forming a government, which would have meant, for the first time in a decade, Netanyahu would be a part of the opposition while he stood trial for breach of trust, bribery, and fraud. That trial, by the way, is still ongoing. But look, between Netanyahu's determination to remain in power, his own ideological views that he is simply not going to be the agent of delivery for anything that looks like a settlement that would satisfy Palestinian needs and requirements, the drift in Israel to the right, the regional turmoil over the last decade. And while Donald Trump is no longer president, I have to say, without demonstrating direct causality, that Trump's decision, largely for domestic political reasons, in my judgment, to create this sugar high for Israel over the last 4 years, which enabled Netanyahu, and at the same time to wage a political and economic war against the Palestinians. I worked for half a dozen administrations of both parties. I never, nor has there ever been an administration that provided all of the honey to Israel and all of the vinegar to the Palestinians. Now, let's be clear. This is also not one hand clapping. The Palestinians bear their fair share of responsibility for where we are today. The Palestinian National Movement looks like Noah's Ark. There are two of everything, two constitutions, two sets of security services, two visions of where Palestine is and what it's supposed to be between Hamas and Fatah. Mahmoud Abbas, despite public desire for these elections, 93% of the population was actually registered to vote, decided, because he would have been challenged by at least three separate blocks, to cancel the elections, which created additional frustration, probably gave Hamas, again, a justification to do what they did. So, having watched and participated in this for so long, I've come to this conclusion. I haven't given up hope because, as Elie Wiesel rightly said, without hope, there is no life. But I have to say, Diane, I've abandoned whatever illusions I had when I was working.
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Aaron David Miller.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Aaron David Miller. He's senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Miller was a Middle East negotiator in both Democratic and Republican administrations. So where do we go from here? Do you see an all-out war coming?
No. I think that if the current pattern between Israel and Hamas follows the three other episodes in 08, 09, 2012 and 2014, the two sides will reach. And I was informed by someone who is knowledgeable on this subject, not someone in the Biden administration, but someone who's talking to all of the parties, that it was their sense that within 24 to 48 hours, there would be the beginnings of a stand down. And it will be delivered if, in fact, it does come by Egypt. I think the odds of a ceasefire and a quiet for quiet quid pro quo is certainly possible, more possible now, once the two sides truly believe they've accomplished everything they want to and that they now risk losing part of what they've accomplished. The Israelis have made a judgment, I think, 5 or 6 days ago that the international community was turning against them. President Biden's decision to pursue a very low-key role and to adopt a position in which he only yesterday mentioned the idea of a ceasefire has, I think, to some degree, buoyed Netanyahu's confidence that, at least so far, the Biden administration is not going to oppose his campaign against Hamas. And I'm told that Hamas wants a ceasefire. The Israelis have done an enormous amount of damage, certainly you have episodic delivery of electricity and water. You've got thousands of Palestinians who are now double refugees. They're refugees to begin with, and now they're out of their homes. We talked about the asymmetry of casualties. Hamas has lost a fair number of fighters. The production facilities for their high trajectory weapons have been undermined. Their tunnel structure has been badly weakened. So I think that we might see this coming week, a stand down.
So is what you see, or is what the Israelis see as public opinion turning against them, particularly in light of the number of deaths of Palestinians and children, is that causing the U.S. behind the scenes to put pressure on Israel and somehow at the same time put similar pressure on the Palestinians and to succeed in doing that?
I think that the arc that you've described, I think, is an accurate one. And as long as we don't have in the next 2 or 3 days a mass casualty event, a Hamas rocket that kills large numbers of Israelis, or an errant Israeli artillery shell or airstrike that kills, I'm really talking mass casualty event here, I think that the arc appears to be heading toward tamping down the violence. It's gone from, in terms of the Biden administration, it's gone from a green light, which existed in the first week, to a yellow light, which I think has been blinking for the last couple of days as a consequence of everything that you've identified.
And who has been delivering those messages?
Biden's now talked to the prime minister 3 times. And I suspect that the private conversation has been a lot tougher than the public one. I'm hoping, Diane, that one of the reasons the Biden administration has decided to stand with the Israelis on the Hamas issue is that Biden understands he's putting leverage and currency in the bank because he's demonstrated he has Israel's back. And if I'm right, in the post-conflict phase, he'll be in a better position to press the Israelis to deal with some of the triggers to this event, most of which, frankly, I think are in the Jerusalem area. Suspending, if not eliminating, the Sheikh Jarrah evictions, stopping housing demolitions, restraining and controlling the extreme right from provoking the situation, stopping high-profile Israeli building in the Jerusalem area. I don't know which of these menu items the Biden administration is going to pursue, but the only logic I can discern is that providing support for Israel against their legitimate concerns with Hamas could conceivably allow the Biden administration more leverage to press the Israelis on a variety of issues that are not security related.
But you're still left with hundreds of thousands of Palestinians locked into a small land space. How do you bring this down? How do you say, well, okay, it's over now. Now we're okay for now. What to prevent it all from starting up again 6 months, 9 months, a year from now?
Right. It's the question that's been asked in the wake of the last three confrontations, particularly after 2014. And people had all kinds of ideas. We're going to disarm Hamas. And in exchange for getting Hamas to give up its weapons, we're going to launch a Middle East Marshall Plan to improve life in Gaza. But that has proven to be entirely impossible, in part because Hamas is not prepared to give up its enclave. However badly it governs, it's not prepared to give up the armed struggle, which it perceives and which this conflict may actually have strengthened, the notion that it, not Abbas, emerges as a defender of the Palestinian people. Now, there's one other perverse issue here, and that is the view of the prime minister, which is he's much more comfortable with what I call a three-state solution than a two-state. You've got a statelet in the West Bank. Abbas controls 40%. Israelis control 60% of the West Bank. Hamas controls Gaza. And then you have the state of Israel. In a way, Hamas serves as an insurance policy for some in Israel. I know the prime minister believes this, to guarantee that Israel will be freed from making concessions, because unless you have one gun, one authority, one negotiating position, no one is going to ask the Israelis to withdraw from territory. And Israel also knows that a vacuum in Gaza is bad for their interests. You know, it's stunning that in the wake of 9/11 and the emergence of Al-Qaeda and the ISIS derivatives, the Israeli-Palestinian issue and arena has been freed from efforts on the part of those groups to take advantage of a very emotional issue in the Muslim, Sunni Muslim world. And it's in part because Hamas and Israel and Abbas and Israel have coordinated on the security side to prevent that from happening. So Israelis don't want Hamas out of Gaza. They just want a quiet Hamas.
So what role do you see Egypt and perhaps even Syria playing in how this plays out?
I think the Egyptians, because of geography and politics, and they are the largest and most powerful Arab state, and they have their own Muslim Brotherhood problem. And remember, Hamas is a derivative of the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood. I think the Egyptians will play the critical role in delivering the ceasefire. From then on, it's unclear. Sisi has a stake in demonstrating to the Biden administration, because they're on his case for human rights abuses, that he is of value. And he is of utility in this equation. And I think if he does produce a ceasefire, he will have picked up a few points clearly in Washington. But it's also instructive. I think Syrians are so bogged down in their own broken internal house. The interesting question is the two states that Mr. Trump and Mr. Kushner got to move closer to Israel, the UAE and Bahrain, will play almost no role in this, which is interesting. I remember when I first sat with Mr. Kushner, he made it unmistakably clear to me they were really not interested in the Palestinian issue. These are my words, not his. He implied that he was much more interested in the 22-state solution, meaning Israel's bilateral relations with the Arab world, and not interested in the two-state solution. So, I mean, again, I'll come back to this. I think that Trump's policy on the Middle East created the sugar high for the Israelis, which convinced them there was this zone of immunity. And it so undermined, forget Hamas for a moment, it so undermined the Palestinian Authority that it created a sense of weakness and grievance there.
So we are in a state of affairs where the Biden administration did not have the Israeli-Palestinian issue at the top of its foreign policy list. So I would imagine that they'd like to see this conflict end as soon as possible. But once it does end, what role will the U.S. play then, considering what you've just said about what Donald Trump did?
I must say that I've been trying to persuade people whether they listen or not, that this president faces the greatest challenge of national recovery of any president since Franklin Roosevelt. In his own mind, there's no foreign policy issue out there that's more damaging or dangerous to his presidency or the future of the American Republic than the three or four inextricably linked crises that we are now facing at home. That means he has very little bandwidth, time and attention, and resources to spend on. He's picking his foreign policy issues carefully. And the one he's chosen in the Middle East is not this one. It's, of course, how to make sure you don't end up with an Israeli-Iranian conflict over the nuclear issue. Because that conflict, unlike the one we're witnessing, could lead to plunging economic and financial markets, rising oil prices, and the prospects of the United States being drawn into a real war as a consequence of Iran's nuclear issue. So I would like to think, but I wonder if it's not the triumph of hope over experience again, that Mr. Biden, now having currency in the bank because of his support for Israel against Hamas, would become more active. We need an ambassador, Diane. We do not have an ambassador in Israel. The Biden administration has committed to putting a consul general back. We need to get someone out there. We need to appoint not necessarily a high-level envoy, but somebody who knows what they're doing, he or she who knows what they're doing and will be prepared to take this on 24/7, not to resolve it. I don't think there's no one I know on the pro-Israeli side or the pro-Palestinian side that actually believes if you got Mahmoud Abbas and Benjamin Netanyahu at the same negotiating table, the discussion would be over in 5 minutes, because the gaps on Jerusalem, borders, security, refugees are as wide as the Grand Canyon. And we don't need another failure. We really don't. So, I mean, I would like to believe that the administration will use its newfound leverage to address some of the issues that triggered this round, but I'm not sure about that at all. One last point. If you look at, Charlie Cook took a look at incumbents' parties from 1946 to the present, how their parties did in the first midterms, the average loss, Republican or Democrat, was 22 seats in the House and 3 in the Senate. 22 in the House and 3 in the Senate. So you see the nature of the problem here.
And some of the Democrats in the Congress are criticizing Biden for the steps he has taken because they feel he has supported Israel outwardly or inwardly far too much and has left the Palestinians hanging.
Right. And I think if Biden judged that this issue was somehow even remotely ready so that his intervention could actually produce a better outcome, I think the political support for that on the part of the Democrats, not just the progressives, by the way, moderate Democrats are probably greater than ever. But I'm not entirely certain that, well, I'm pretty sure that Biden understands the investment that would be required to deal with this, and the fact that it would involve a certain amount, I'll be diplomatic here, a certain amount of unpleasantness with the Israelis. And whether or not he wants to take that on right now, I don't know.
What do you think about Secretary Blinken?
I think his instincts are correct. He understands why nations behave the way they do. And his singular advantage is that he probably is the closest Secretary of State to the president since Baker's relationship with H.W. Bush. But the world is a cruel and unforgiving place, and all the low-hanging fruit, rejoining Paris Climate, rejoining the WHO, reversing the Muslim ban, extending New START with the Russians, softening up our immigration policy to make it hopefully more humane on the border, all of that has now been picked. What's left is Syria, Israelis and Palestinians, how to manage China, what to do about Russia. And for a president preoccupied with fixing America's broken house, there's not a lot of political bandwidth for a Secretary of State to be very risk ready. And if you look at the last 5 months of the Biden administration's foreign policy, the most risky decision they've taken, I would argue, is Afghanistan. They've done something that their three predecessors refused to do, which was to set a date certain for withdrawal. as painful as it's going to be, and as bad as the outcome of our withdrawal is going to be. That's risky. But on everything else, they've been very, very cautious.
Finally, you've said that you cannot envision at the moment or in the foreseeable future a pathway for Palestinians and Israelis to end their decades-long conflict.
I've abandoned my illusions, but I don't have the right, nor would I ever appropriate it, that right, to say never. I mean, we occupy a tiny space for a very short period of time on this planet, and we have to be very modest and humble about the future. I'm not going to mortgage my kids' futures. I'm not going to mortgage the future of Israel and the Palestinians by saying this can never happen. It's just that the factors that are required to make it happen, and there are three: leaders who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their constituencies or their ideologies. A sense of ownership. You've heard the famous expression, in the history of the world, nobody ever washed a rental car. People don't wash rental cars because people care about what they own to a fault. There's an absence of ownership. If I were to tell you that the three great breakthroughs in this conflict, Israel-Egypt, Israel-Jordan, Israel-Palestinians, came about without the participation of the United States, that's emblematic of what is required. The Arabs and the Israelis have to want to do this. It's so hard. Rabin gave his life. Sadat gave his life at the Camp David summit 20 years ago, last July. I heard Arafat say several times, "You're not going to walk behind my coffin." And what he meant by that is, this is not just a political issue for me. He sat in the same cabin as Sadat and Begin. And I wonder what he was thinking. Well, Barak sat in the same cabin too. So leadership, ownership, and finally, somebody, a third party, is going to have to help if one of the first two conditions are present.
And you don't see that.
Well, it's a third party, Diane, that has to be prepared to apply ample amounts of honey, but ample amounts of vinegar too. And the last administration that I worked for that was prepared to do that was one of the most talented secretaries of state in the modern period of the United States, James Baker. Bush 41 and James Baker understood how to negotiate, and there was an opportunity to do that. You know, someone asked me, if you could turn back the clock or if there were a rewind button on history, what would you change? And I answer very quickly. Rabin would not have been murdered, and I voted Democratic more than I voted Republican. And I would say, had Bill Clinton not defeated George H.W. Bush in 1992, you would have had Baker and Bush and Rabin. And I believe that with those two, you could have completed the third point of the triangle, either by convincing Arafat or Assad, one of the two. And you and I today would be having a very different conversation had that happened.
Aaron, thank you so much.
Well, Diane, thank you for giving me the opportunity both to see you again virtually and to participate in this wonderful podcast.
That was Aaron David Miller. He's Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was a Middle East negotiator in both Democratic and Republican administrations. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Reed.